Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. And speaking of recovery, it's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery up there in Morgan, Utah. It's an all-female recovery center specializing in ladies and getting them back on their road to recovery. For more information, check them out online at ReprieveRC.com. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley.
Can I call you a sidekick?
Sure thing. I'd love to be your sidekick.
Or co-host.
I like sidekick.
Sidekick, Dr. Yeah. Matt Woolley.
Yeah, it's good to see you, man.
Clinical psychologist.
That's true, yeah.
And what does that mean?
That means we work on clinical problems. Problems that you usually think of that you take you to a shrink. You know, depression, anxiety, addictions,
and a lot of the,
like,
you know, depression, anxiety are a lot of reasons why people use.
Oh, absolutely. No, in fact, I'm convinced that emotional problems, including things like, you know, depression and anxiety, are some of the main reasons people continue to use even when they realize they have a problem, because they use to get that immediate relief from those other issues. Sometimes it starts as fun, but it usually progresses into something like self-medicating.
Yeah, I'm with you. I've been there, done that.
But you're past it, though.
Well, I'm working on it. You know, every time I get on Facebook and I go to our Facebook page and that, people go, "You got it." And when I was in recovery, the Pinnacle Recovery Center, anytime anybody said, "You got it," it was kind of like, ooh. You never want to say you got it, because as soon as you get complacent, that's when it starts to fall down. So I always say, I don't got it yet, but I'm giving it all I got.
I think that's absolutely the right way to look at it, right? You can't get complacent if you want to keep your behavior change going. But I think we've had such a great response from Facebook. I think people are just, they want to encourage you and they want to say, like, you've got it, like, keep going. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's the message.
I get what they're meaning.
People enjoy seeing other people be successful and overcome things.
That's what's so great about this community now that I'm in it, is that they are so generous and they are so willing to help you out. And when I was alone in my addiction, sitting on the back deck, drinking a 12-pack, smoking a cigar, I felt alone. Just 100% alone.
Yeah, well, you literally were.
I was alone, but I didn't think anybody would relate, know what I'm going through.
You feel emotionally isolated, and that's why people don't talk about it, is they think, well, no one's really going to understand my problem. And there's a lot of different ways to justify, like, either they feel like maybe my problem's not as big as someone else's problem, or, you know, people might think I've got a sweet life. How could I have any problems? But the reality is, if you don't start talking about it, if you don't create the conversation, like, I hope our podcast is doing, then you stay in that isolated state. So we've got to reach out and talk and realize that many of us have addictive and compulsive problems and behaviors, and we just don't talk about it.
I get a lot of people going, I'm not even addicted to alcohol or drugs, but I know I've got an addictive personality, and this podcast is really helping me.
I was just on KSL News Radio talking about the shopping addiction and how people are, the retail therapy is actually triggering dopamine in our brains. And it's very similar to taking pills and smoking weed and drinking alcohol. It's this quick fix, and it creates this roller coaster of emotions for people, but it wrecks your life with debt.
Yeah. Hey, you know, we're talking about addiction, and that's what this podcast is about. And you said, you know, not a lot of people are talking about it, except for our guest today, Court McGee, Utah native, UFC champion, Ultimate Fighter winner, and resident bad boy. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's
not
a very
bad boy response.
I mean, if we were going to throw fisticuff in this room, how many of us would walk out?
One.
Just one.
I think we all know who it would be.
But, Court, you started in Utah, and you've got an amazing story. And here on the podcast, we like to talk about people's journey into addiction and then celebrate their journey out. So if you don't mind, how did your journey to addiction begin?
Well, I mean, I'm a Utah native. I grew up in Layton, Utah, just off of Hill Air Force Base. Had a great family. I have parents that have been married for almost 40 years, 40 years this year. And one older brother who's educated and lives in Torrance, California, and works on light rail. But early on, I was an athlete, and I was rambunctious, and you could say I have that addictive personality. I over-concentrate on one thing, and I just go full bore at it. And at a young age, I sustained a couple of injuries during high school wrestling, and then I had started drinking. And when I mixed the pain pills with the alcohol, it affected me And I lost everything, you know, shortly thereafter. I graduated high school, went to college for 6 months.
But I want to go back real quick because you said something I think that will strike a chord with a lot of the listeners here on Project Recovery is that you had a great family, you know, and your parents were married and you did the sports and all that. And I think a lot of times people think addicts are addicts because some traumatic event or some upbringing. And I'm not discounting that. I think a lot of people are led down that road because of some of those events. But a lot of times people just get into it because they do, right?
Well, I mean, if you look at the disease of addiction in itself, it can be inherent in your personality long before you take a drink or a drug. And so for me, I think the disease of addiction was inherent in my personality long before I took that first drink.
We see it run in families, and that's a very good thing for our listeners to pause and think about. Do I have addiction in my family history? If so, I need to pay attention to what I'm doing to avoid that.
Yeah, you're way more likely to struggle from addiction. And I mean, if you have issues at home or issues yourself, and that starts earlier, I mean, that's why you end up dropping out of school. You know, we're one of the most hardest hit states in the country. I think we're ranked in this, you know, number 6, number 7 in the country for accidental overdose and drug overdose deaths. And, you know, that's that I am a typical story of what happened. I went from pain pills to heroin, you know, in a short period of time.
The opioid addiction that's happening around the country, I mean, that really is where you most likely had a predisposition towards addiction for various reasons, but then you were introduced to it, I guess we could kind of say honestly, you were just getting treatment for your injuries.
Yeah, sustained some injuries. I had a shattered collarbone. I was prescribed pain pills. It wasn't fixed, and so 2 weeks later, we got a second opinion, and then it was like, hey, we need to get in and fix this collarbone. So I had a surgery, and I had already been taking pain pills, so it extended that. And, you know, you talk about becoming dependent just after 4 or 5 days or 7 days. Mm-hmm. And it's like, not only was I dependent within those 4 or 5 days, but the addiction, the allergy to that opiate just took everything from me. I was like, wow, what's this? See, I lost a scholarship because of Title IX, Women's and Men's Fairness in Sports. And there was no colleges in the state of Utah in 2003 that had wrestling programs except for clubs. And so I was kind of at a loss. And then I had already started abusing the pain pills. And I thought, I can't leave the state and go wrestle because I won't be able to find my medicine. I won't be able to go find
the pain pills. Wow, so you're already limiting this awesome option of being a college athlete just to maintain the pills.
Yeah.
Wow.
Do you remember what the pills did for you, you know, for your mental state and your body? I mean, was it a euphoric feeling or did it kind of just, because I've heard some people describe it as it put a hole, it fixed a hole that was in them, and others that it just numbed out.
Well, here's the situation I was in. Growing up, I was either going to find a career after high school, as long as I graduate, which was super important in my family. Find a career, work there for 30 years and retire, or go to college, find a career, work there for 30 years and retire. And that was like, that was my options. And neither of those options sounded great to me. And I was confused and I was 18 years old and thinking, what the heck am I going to do? My brother went to college, so I thought, okay, maybe I'll go to college too. But I'm not going to college to wrestle. I wasn't going to college to get an education. I was going to college to wrestle to become a better MMA fighter. See, I watched a documentary at like maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. I had only been in martial arts. I had done some city league wrestling, and I just saw this Mark Kerr smashing machine documentary, and I thought, that's what I want to do. That is what I'm going to do. And now, so,
do you think that your addiction, like in like I say to people, that I'm all in on whatever I'm doing. If it was drinking, I'm all in.
Yep.
If it's exercise, I'm all in. If it's a Netflix show, I'm all in.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that helps me and hurts me. Do you feel you're the same kind of personality?
Yeah, no, I definitely am. And I was faced with these options, and I thought, what do I do? What do I do? And then that's where the pain pills came in. And so the euphoric feeling you were talking about, like at the suggestion of a friend, he said, hey, listen, crush this pill up and snort it, and it, like, takes care of all the pain that you're in and gives you tons of energy. And I was like, man, that's not a good idea. You know, I mean, I wasn't even the kid that snorted pixie sticks when you're young, you know, it's like, I'm like, I don't know about this. And so I sucked off the coating. I crushed it up. I snorted it and I didn't get high. And I said, I'm going to try it one more time. And then that's it. I tried it one more time and it hit me. And I was like, you know what? I'll figure it out. You know, whatever happens, happens. It'll be okay. Everything will be okay now. So it was like a comfort. Like, well, yeah, I'll go to school and I'll just, you know, go to school and then figure it out. And then that's what started my journey, was crushing up that Oxycontin and snorting it. And that's from that point on, it was like fast forward a year later by the snap of my fingers, boom. And I had quit going to college. I increased my use tremendously. I did whatever I could. To get the pain pills. And then when they didn't have pain pills and all they had was cocaine, you know, it was like, well, I'll do cocaine. It'll give me some energy for work, you know. And then pretty soon it was like I was getting close to getting fired, so I had to quit and go find a new job. But then I had to sober up for the new job. And so I'd sober up for 2 or 3 days, and I'd be like, okay, hey, you know what? Maybe I can sober up. Maybe I don't have a problem. And as long as I have a job, I'm not a drug addict. And then I started getting the consequences where – I get a DUI arrest, and then I get arrested for this, and I get arrested for that. And then pretty soon it was just, you know, it was taking care of pain. Plus I had started drinking during the summers in high school, but only on the weekends because I work full time. So I thought I was managing it. I was just having fun. And the feeling was so elusive that I had to continue to do it. But now I started having consequences. So it was fun with consequences. And then, like maybe a year out of high school, it was all consequences. I had lost everything around me. I had a pretty steady girlfriend all through high school, friendship for the first couple of years, and then pretty steady, you know. And a year out of high school and a year into college, she's just like, I can't do this anymore. You're in too much trouble all the time. And so we separated, and I really hit a bottom after that. I was like, man, I don't have anybody left. My parents kicked me out of the house. My brother was sick of bailing me out and hearing the same old story, like, oh, it's not my fault, you know, I just got caught, or I this and that. And then I didn't have any friends around me except for the two friends that I grew up with, which all three of us had one thing in common, is we started using about the same time because of injuries. And we continued that, but our relationship went from friendship of fishing, working out together, even wrestling together, to just using drugs together, and that's all we could do. And then our lives were crashing down around us. And, you know, I ended up getting kicked out of the little apartment I was at. I got fired from the job. I admitted that I had a problem with alcohol, and they said, we don't have room for you here, but if you get sober, we want you back. You're a great employee. And that was it. And I just thought, what the heck am I doing? And within a couple of weeks, I had lost the place I was living. I was couch surfing, and then I ran out of couches to surf, and I had nobody else to turn to. And then I found heroin, and I shot up for the first time, and all my problems went away. All the disappointment in my father's eyes went away. All the disappointment in my mother's eyes, losing the wrestling career, not going on to college in wrestling, not having a career. All of a sudden it was like heroin said, you know what, dude, that's all right. As long as you got me.
But the reality is it didn't go away. The disappointment was still there.
Everything was still there. It was an illusion, and that illusion was the disease of addiction. That illusion was, if you use me, everything will be okay. But everything was not okay, and it continued to get worse. I had a cousin that was just wonderful, and she said, you know what, you can move into my trailer. She was clean at the time. She had been doing really well, and she said, just as long as you don't use drugs here. You can drink a little bit, but you can't use drugs here.
Now, how long had you been living this lifestyle? I mean, because you say, you know, a year after high school, you're out of college, you're not going to college, you've got some DUIs, you've lost a couple of jobs. How long was this lifestyle going for you?
From 18 to halfway through 19.
I mean, that's a pretty fast trip. You went from not being a drug abuser to a year later picking up heroin.
Yep. Drinking on weekends. The only thing that stopped me from drinking through high school, especially in the fall and spring, was wrestling at late in high school and my coach. And I thought, I can't do anything that interferes with my wrestling. But by the time high school ended and I lost that scholarship, it was like
motivation.
I didn't have that. There was no motivation to stop. So it was kind of like, okay, well, now I can drink after work.
Mm-hmm. But when I would like put limitations on it, I always pass those limitations. And within a couple of months of drinking like that, like I had to drink in the morning just to get rid of the shakes. I mean, it was bad. And then
we had,
you know,
Randall Carlisle in, and he said there was times in his addiction that he'd have to drink 3 beers just so he could shave, just so his hands would stop shaking, so he could shave.
I mean, to be completely honest, so I was 20, so I had to have somebody buy my alcohol for me. Mm. And I was working at this construction job, and so I'd get a temporary hire guy, and I would offer to buy him a pint of whiskey if he bought me a pint of, like, vodka or whiskey or whatever. And so I would do that. I would take 2 or 3 swigs at like 10 or 11 a.m. and then try and eat something so I'd cover up the smell. And then as soon as I got off work, the neighbor that I was living in these little apartments, I would say, hey, will you buy me an 18-pack? I'll buy you a 6-pack. And he would do that. I'd buy an 18-pack, and I'd say, okay, I'm only going to drink 16 and wake up with 2. Sometimes if I ended up drinking the 18-pack, I woke up and I was suffering. And, you know, if I didn't, I would leave 2 for the morning. I would drink those 2, get to work. Work for the first couple of hours, and then buy that whiskey, take a couple shots of whiskey, and then as soon as work got done, I would go right back and get more.
And that's that addiction mindset. All of a sudden, everything you do starts to center around maintaining and promoting your use. And so yep. You're planning. You just beautifully walked through how an addict thinks about their 24 hours. You know, what am I going to do from the time I get up to before I go to work?
I can't buy beer before 7 o'clock. I can't buy it after 1 o'clock. I've got to make sure that I've got it.
Yep.
And if you don't, it's like you're missing an appendage. Your arm's gone. You're like, what am I going to do? This is, I can't go 8 hours without a beer. I can't do that. That's my story.
The body aches from the excessive drinking. Pain pills would take care of that pain. Not to mention, if I had pain pills, then I could take pain pills, achieve a certain level of high, still work, and not smell like alcohol. Mm. And then the cocaine would help wake me up and get me going, but most of the time I couldn't stop. And if I ended up, they only had a certain amount of cocaine and I bought that much cocaine, I would use that much cocaine, and then here comes nighttime, I got to go to sleep. So I got to either smoke some weed, drink myself to sleep, or find some Xanax to help me go to sleep. And so you get into this vicious cycle super quick.
It's like the devil's food pyramid.
Yeah. And then 18 months out of high school, maybe 6 or 7 months after quitting college and then going to work, I was able to move into the trailer. I stayed there, and I had been shooting heroin. And I found another job, landscaping. You know, I lied to the guy to get in. Yep, I'm clean. I'm this and this. And, you know, I showed up to work. And I just thought, as long as I have a little bit of heroin to make it throughout the day, I'll be okay. And that turned into shooting up like 40 or 50 times a day, just little micro doses all throughout the day just to maintain and manage. And to get that, to find that, making $10 an hour mowing lawns was challenging. So I had to, like, sell weed. I had to become a drug dealer. And just to keep that high. And then, you know, that day, September 9th, 2005, came. It was a Sunday. I was in the trailer, and I shot up the normal amount I was going to shoot up. I had a little bit for the morning, and either it was too pure, or maybe it was cut with some fentanyl, or maybe I shot up a little bit more, but that was my overdose. And, I mean, a lot happened before that, but I overdosed September 9th, 2005, at like 10 p.m. SportsCenter did a piece.
Yeah.
The Sports Center, ESPN, like the Sports Center piece they did, Dead Man Fighting, the Court McGee story.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot up and I went, oh, and then that was it. I fell over. And I mean, the things that happened that night for me to be here today are incredible nonetheless. But it's like I hit the floor and my cousin and her friend came home from shopping. They were going to go out to eat. From my understanding, and they bought some ice cream, so they had to drop the ice cream off so it wouldn't melt.
Mm.
And they came in, and, you know, like there was somebody else there, and, you know, I was stuck in the bathroom. I went into the bathroom to hide my using, and I had fallen in between the wall, the door, off of the toilet, so the door was slammed shut, and they were standing outside of the door, banging on the door, trying to get in, like, hey, and I don't know what happened to Court, he fell down. And they came in, they ended up breaking the door down, they called 911. There was an ambulance within, you know, like 2 or 3 minutes, I think, from when the call to when
they
got there.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So were you breathing? Do you know?
No. So they called the ambulance and they called my mom and dad. My mom and dad got there. They were like about 3 miles away. So they got there really quick. The ambulance got there before they got there. And they ended up breaking the door down. They pulled me out. They started CPR. They got me into the ambulance. They did CPR and defibrillations in the ambulance. But they said I was like, when they pulled me out of the bathroom, like I was like non-responsive and like blue. I was in an overdose. And so like every 20 or 30 seconds, I would take like a big deep of breath. And then that stopped. But they started CPR. They did CPR and defibrillations for like 16 or 17 minutes.
Wow.
But I had no pulse and no heartbeat for like 8 minutes. And that was in Davis Hospital. And so I was gone. And then there was an undercover narcotics officer who had like arrested me multiple times for other incidences earlier. And he moved to undercover narcotics and he found the syringe that I overdosed on. So the trailer was clean except for my heroin that I had in my glass case. And that was closed and pushed off onto the floor. And then the syringe that I OD'd on had fallen in between the linoleum and the wall. There was an edge that lifted up and it was just sitting there. So he found the syringe and he called and said, "Hey, it's a heroin overdose."
And tell everybody why that's important.
So they wouldn't, I was in renal failure and like my body was starting to shut down and they used Narcalone or Narcan and they reversed the effect of the opioid overdose.
But if they hadn't known what you overdosed on, they wouldn't have known to be able to do that.
Exactly.
Right.
At all. So I wouldn't be here. They would have just stopped the chest compressions after 20 minutes or whatever their
pronounced you dead
is, and pronounced me dead. And I would have been the next opiate overdose.
Right.
And instead, like, they were able to reduce the effect by administering the Narcalone, and then they induced me into a coma because they didn't know how long I was out for. And I was in there. I'm not sure how long I was in there, but when I came out of the coma, I know that a few people had called this licensed clinical social worker who also had over 20 years of continuous recovery, complete abstinence from drugs and alcohol, and he was a former heroin addict. And he came in, and I had talked with my dad a little bit. I had a friend that I grew up with that came and talked to me, and I don't remember what I said to him. I didn't know why I was there. My chest was in a considerable amount of pain. They broke my sternum and my ribs.
Yeah.
I mean, I had tubes, and I was like, where am I? What happened? I was out of it. And then this guy came in there, and he was, the best way to describe him was a role model with a solution. I mean, it was fall. Close to winter, it was cold, and he came in with shorts on and like a Hawaiian shirt, and he just like scooted across the floor in his sandals, and he talked to me, and after 5 minutes, I knew he knew the pain that I had been in.
Mm-hmm. Why was that so important to you?
Because I didn't feel like anybody understood how bad it was. Like, I wanted to stop, and I tried to stop, but I couldn't. I knew I was damaging and ruining everything around me. And my only solution was to continue to use to get rid of those problems, but it just put a Band-Aid on them. It didn't actually solve the problems. And so when that guy said, "Listen, this is where I've been. This is my story." In 5 minutes, I was like, man, that guy,
he gets
was homeless.
It.
He's lost everything. And now he's got multiple years, like, and I don't know exactly
Hawaiian
how he put it. And I was just like, man, he's so calm and he's happy. And he's like, "Listen, man." He said, there's a bed at this hospital, Highland Ridge Hospital. You got to go there, and then you got to attend recovery meetings and listen to what they have to say. I'll call you while you're in there, and I'll come visit you. And that's one of your options. And then my parents came in, and I remember my parents said, okay, so this is your only option, because if you leave here, you don't have us. You're done. And I would have got arrested. That narcotics officer.
If you rejected the help that was
If I rejected
offered.
The help, yep. I you're on your own.
Yep.
So you just died, and now you've had an intervention in your hospital room.
Yep.
And this guy gives you a way out.
Yep.
And your thoughts? I mean, did you even debate it?
I didn't, because when he shared with me some of his experience, I went, this guy's not lying to me. He's telling the truth.
It was genuine.
And he made like two suggestions. And he's like, if you do this, man, you can have freedom from all of this. You can go. You can go without drinking and using, and you can live a really good life, but you've got to trust me. And I was like, man, I trust this guy.
And why was this guy doing this?
I don't know. because somebody called somebody that called somebody who ended up being in recovery, and in his recovery, he decided he wanted to go to school and become a licensed clinical social worker. And then he decided he was going to help drug addicts. And I was a drug addict that needed help. And so late at night, he came into a hospital and talked to a drug addict. And after 5 minutes, made a couple of suggestions, and I was willing to do it. And so that's what I did. I was whisked off to Highland Ridge Hospital. I was in the psych ward for like a week, and then I got out, and then they started taking me to recovery meetings, and they started doing group therapy and started doing what people in recovery do in treatment centers. And I was surrounded by people who were trying to get sober and people who had achieved sobriety and licensed clinical staff and other people who, and I was like, wow, you know, like this is something. And I went to this recovery meeting, and this big guy stood up and he said, you know, he talked about rebuilding a relationship with his mom, which I knew I had lost with mine. And he said, if I stay sober, clean and sober for one more day, I'll have 6 months of continuous recovery. And I was like, holy cow, that guy's telling the truth. So I started calling that guy and I started talking to that guy. He gave me a few suggestions and I had a few slips, once in treatment, one like 3 days out, only one day, like one time. And then I stayed completely sober for like 5.5 months. And then somebody slid and I had a sober 21st birthday and I was feeling good. I had dedicated some time at Layton High School as an assistant coach under Mike Hansen, like his last year of wrestling. And I was just like, holy cow, like my whole life had changed.
You found a groove.
Yeah. And I was like, man, I can accomplish anything. I can do anything. And I just was like, man, this is incredible. Now, I suggested not to hang with people I used to hang with that were drinking and stuff. And I thought maybe I was different. I thought, you know what? I can still be around these guys, you know? And I had a bunch of criminal charges, felony drug charges from the heroin overdose, plus charges that I'd had that were already, you know, like previously charged. I was dealing with that stuff. And I was just like, man, I don't know. I, you know, a lot of stress, but I knew there was hope if I stayed sober, continued to attend recovery meetings and keep around that group of people. And I just thought maybe I can help some of my old friends. And I ended up going on a trip with this group, and one of the people had relapsed and they slid a drink my way, and I put it up to my lips and I set it down and I was thinking, man, this is not a good idea. And one of them said, well, that's pretty much a relapse, but if we both drink tonight, we can get sober tomorrow and have the same sobriety birthday. And so I drank that Long Island iced tea, and it led to the worst 2 weeks and one day of my life. But it led me to my bottom. My parents thought I was sober.
That's crazy, because you just talked about dying in a trailer on a bathroom floor and going this, and you haven't reached your rock bottom yet.
Mm-hmm.
And after 5.5 months of sobriety and a Long Island iced tea in 2 weeks plus one day, you finally find your rock bottom. What does that look like?
So I ended up in Iowa 5 days later from Las Vegas, and in a complete blackout drunk. I would have used anything, you know, I was just in a complete blackout. I was asked to come out there to help a friend move some of his dad's stuff. So I rented a Ryder van and we drove out there. And I mean, I was drunk the whole time. And, you know, we switched from driver to driver. And I mean, I couldn't participate with it. I couldn't move anything. I couldn't do anything. And I ended up out in Iowa, you know, to my closest friend. And he's just like, dude, you're a mess, man. He knew I'd been through treatment. You know, he knew, oh, no, I'm just having a little bit of beer, you know. And like, he knew that it was bad. And he's like, man, you got to go back and get help. You know, you got to do whatever. Well, I wasn't supposed to leave the state. And I had been to like multiple states. I yeah. had all these problems. I had not got a job. I was not following any of the suggestions I was given from the people in recovery. And I just was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to drink myself to death. And then as soon as I get back, I'll go turn myself in to the district attorney, and I'll go to prison, and then I can get sober in prison, and I can, and it'll work. It's confined. There's structure. Like, that's where I need to be. That's probably the best place for me. My parents won't have to worry about me. I won't be surrounded by my friends. Like, I'll just be in prison. I'll do what I need to do, and I'll get some clean time, and you know, everything will work out, and that's what I'll do. So I made it back home.
So prison was your recovery plan?
Yeah, and I thought that's where I deserved to be.
And that kind of shows how our focus, our thought process gets warped and changed through the process of being addicted to something, that something like prison sounds like a logical option.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you're planning on, well, that's the best place for me to go. And you felt like you deserved that. So that self-esteem was down and that logical reasoning was down. And everything gets destroyed when you're in the throes of that addictive process.
Yeah. And then one thing happened a couple of months prior to that. I donated time at Layton High School as an assistant coach, and it sparked something in me. I wanted to compete. I had lost my option to compete before that, and so I started teaching wrestling at a jiu-jitsu gym and started learning jiu-jitsu as well as doing some kickboxing and some boxing. And so I thought maybe that's what I would end up doing. And so around that time, I had started training, and that sparked. So fast forward, April 16th, 2006, I show up to my parents' house under the assumption that I'm completely sober, because I was not allowed there. But because I was sober, they were going to give me a couple days to stay there, and then I had to find a place to live and, of course, work and start taking care of, you know, court fines and restitution and fees and lawyer costs and all that stuff.
Because it all adds up, and it just hangs over you. I think a lot of times people think because you're sober, that stuff goes away.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away. It just becomes more manageable because you're clear-headed and you've got a goal and you've got some attention to it.
Yep. But because of some of the stigma surrounding addiction, it's very challenging. And so I showed up to my parents' house. I knew my dad had some like Milwaukee's Best or Natural Light laying around somewhere. So I snuck around the house and, you know, I was like, okay, I gotta find a beer and then I'll just drink a beer and then I'll figure it out. And he ended up having him hid in his room. So I snuck into the room while my mom and dad were sleeping as 21-year-old adult, snuck into the room, reached into the 12 pack or whatever it was, pulled a beer out, like snuck downstairs, opened the beer up, and I heard the footsteps of my dad coming across the kitchen floor. And I was like, and I put the beer down, and he walked down the stairs, and I remember looking at him, and he said, son, I thought you weren't supposed to drink. And then I set the beer down, and that was 4,786 days ago.
Wow.
That was it.
So you didn't even drink it?
Nope. I was done. I was like, I can't do this anymore. Called the district attorney the next morning and said, hey, I left the state. I've been drinking. I got a bunch of drugs. Stop. Stop right there. I want you to be here Friday, and I want you to be sober. And I was like, it's Monday, and Friday's a long ways away. I can't guarantee anything, but I'll do my best.
That's an eternity.
Yep. And so I started calling those recovery people. My dad had suggested like meeting with one of the guys that he knew that he'd kind of grown up with that owned a small commercial plumbing company. And he's like, hey, go in and talk with him. Maybe he can get you a job. And so Wednesday rolled around. I hadn't drank yet. I hadn't used yet. And I went in basically for an interview. And I sat down and I was just like, he's like, well, tell me about yourself. And I was like, I got a bunch of criminal charges. I'm probably going to prison. And I've got about 3 days of sobriety.
Now you're being honest, just real honest. Yeah.
Probably he's the like, worst interview he's ever had.
Ever.
Yeah.
And he goes, great. Meetings are great. Hey, man. Yeah, you're hired. Be here tomorrow.
Wow. That's great. That's like, an amazing response. What? Yeah.
Yeah. And so the next day, Thursday, I started. And then Friday, after work was over, I went down and I met with the district attorney. And she saw something that I didn't see in myself. She put me in a program for inmates getting out of prison, the NUKE program, on 24th or 25th Street in Ogden. And she said, you got to attend this. It's like 2 or 3 hours every Friday evening, and you need to go to 2 self-help group meetings a week, like an AA or NA, a 12-step meeting. You have to go to 2 of those a week, check in, and then you got to go to this program, and you got to get your signature, as well as you have a color on file, and you've got to do random UAs.
So I'm brown.
Yeah.
I still have to call.
Purple,
call every day.
Yellow, and green. Yep. I remember them. And so that's where it started. And I started attending recovery meetings. And, you know, a couple of months later, I reunited with my high school sweetheart. We started dating again.
How did you pull that off, Court? That's what I want to know. How did
I went
you talk
bowling,
her back
and I had a girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
And she went bowling, and she had a boyfriend. She was actually engaged, and we had talked about getting engaged. She was in recovery as well, the partner that I had at the
Court's
time.
A real man. This girl's engaged.
Yeah.
So we go bowling, and I see Chelsea. Now, she moved to Russia to teach English. Like, so when she left me, she really left me. She moved to Russia to teach English.
Das vidanya.
Yep. And then she came back, and she had heard that, you know, like it was really bad and all, you know, whatever. And so I think she was trying to delete the Court McGee history and
the
just
file,
move
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And I saw her, and I was like, holy cow, it's Chelsea. And so I went up to her, and I was like, Chelsea? And she's like, Court, you're alive? And then she ran over to me. She gave me a hug, and she said, you don't smell like beer. And I was like, I'm completely sober. Only a couple of weeks, but I'm completely sober. And she was like, really? And as she says, I was everything that she wanted me to be without the alcohol and drugs. And, I mean, I fell in love with that girl when I was 15. I chased her for like 2 years and then finally awesome. Conned her into yeah. dating me. And I just loved her to death. Mm. And that and all of a sudden it was there. And so we had separated from our significant others and we started dating. And I started going to work every day and I started making my financial amends with the state through the criminal justice system, my court fees, my lawyer fees, showing up to my meetings, showing up to the Nuke meetings that were on 25th Street. And I just started one day at a time. I went back to the gym. I started training. I got my butt kicked, you know, by all these different people. I started wrestling, and then
so
I started...
there's somebody out there that can say they kicked Court McGee's butt.
Yes. As a matter of fact, so I competed in almost 100 competition jiu-jitsu matches in my first year of competition after getting sober.
Wow.
I competed in 10 amateur boxing matches and 2 professional boxing matches, and in my first year, February 2nd, 2007, just a year after I got sober, I took my first MMA fight. But in that first 6 or 7 months, I had one. Everything was going well. I was paying all my lawyer fees, my court fines, showing up to work. I was doing my piss tests. I was staying. I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing. I was attending meetings. I was surrounding myself with good people.
Winning back girlfriends,
and then had a little baby on the way.
Wow.
And it was like, okay, well, you guys got to get married. And I was like, I need 2 years of sobriety before I get married. You don't know who you're marrying, and I want. And she was like, okay, that sounds good. Yep, focus on your recovery. So I was working full-time as a commercial plumber. I was thinking like, okay, now I'll go back to school. But what happened was I went and I started training at a gym. And I couldn't afford a membership, so the guy was like, you teach us wrestling, I'll teach you jiu-jitsu. And after just a couple of weeks, I started noticing that I was like, better than most of the guys there. And I started to learn little tactics and I started competing in jiu-jitsu. And I went from the beginner, like novice, beginner, intermediate, advanced, absolute division, which is like any weight, any division. And I started beating almost everybody. And I was like, okay, I got to get good at jiu-jitsu. I got to get good at kickboxing. I got to get good at boxing. And I got to continue building on my wrestling because I was a pretty good wrestler. I was a 5A, 2-time 5A state placer, and I won a national high school tournament. So I was good enough to wrestle in college as a D1 athlete. And so I thought, I got to keep up with that. And then CrossFit thing started
CrossFit
going.
CrossFit craze, you bet.
And so I started incorporating CrossFit workouts with my wrestling, with my boxing, with my jiu-jitsu. And I competed all the way to a really high level in jiu-jitsu. I competed in a couple of open tournaments wrestling. And then I got my so there was a Saturday sparring practice where there's all these Hispanic boxers in Clearfield, Utah. There was a 14-year-old kid that came in, and he was about my weight, kind of big, super young. And
You're 21.
I was 21.
He's 14.
14. Pretty tough, pretty strong. I had like a 550 to 570-pound deadlift. Like, wow. I was like
beast mode.
Super.
Yeah.
And this 14-year-old kid – beat the crap out of me.
He's telling that story today.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I got to learn. Can I start training with you and your dad? So we started training. I took my first boxing match, 10 boxing matches later, amateur boxing matches later, two tournaments. I was undefeated, 10-0.
Wow.
And then I took my first professional fight, which was in Ogden at the Eccles Center or the, I can't remember what it was. Gene Fulmer was there and some of the Fulmer brothers. So it was like
and for the listeners,
honor.
Who are those guys?
WBC world champion, the one who beat Sugar Ray Robinson.
There you go.
Yeah. So like a legend in the sport of boxing.
Yeah.
And he was there front row and I got to meet him and like I was like, wow. But I was just, I wanted to do all these sports so I could be an MMA fighter. So all of a sudden my dream started to happen from the age of 9. Like, here we go. This is what I'm going to do. And so I systematically went through the striking, the grappling, the wrestling, and then incorporating the conditioning. And then at 6 months, I had a friend reach out to me who I grew up with. This kid was, we had been friends. I had two close friends, real close friends. And one of them was an artist and the other one was more in like, we were all fishermen. So we all fished together and he had struggled off and on. He was one of those two buddies that I used with all the way till the end. And I had to separate myself from. And he called me and he said, man, I need help stopping. I know you've stopped. How do I stop? And I said, okay, well, throw everything away. Get rid of everything. We'll go to like a recovery meeting and then we'll go fishing sober. So first we went to Cabela's. We were going to buy some tackle and he ended up getting loaded while he was in the store. He went and crushed up some pills and snorted them. Came
right there
back
in
out.
In the store, huh?
In the store, in the bathroom.
Wow.
He denied it at the time, but like he had some powder on his nose and I noticed I knew he had used. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Brady, man, part of the deal was you can't use around me. You know, and he was like, oh, I'm not, you know, it's my prescription or whatever. And I was like, dude, I gotta take you home, man. You're loaded. And so I took him home. We kind of got into an argument and his mom overheard the argument and part of the deal was he had to be sober at the time to be home. And so I think they had an argument like maybe threatened to kick him out. So he called the police and said that there was an altercation in the house. And at 6 months sober, I got arrested for burglary, entering the house with the intent to harm him.
And so he said all that because he was angry at you.
Angry at me and because the disease of addiction had taken over. And he thought that was his best option for him
to
stay
in
survival mode. Yeah. And I don't blame him for that at all. Yeah. At the time, I didn't no longer want to go to prison. And life was picking up.
Didn't seem like a good idea
and
anymore.
I had a career path outside of just the plumbing. The plumbing was just to maintain and pay fines and lawyer fees.
But you were starting to see that vision coming clear.
Starting to see it.
Yeah.
And I had my first fight, February 2nd, 2007. And then all throughout that year, I had six fights. And in my first fight, I fought in Grand Junction, Colorado. And my sixth or seventh professional fight that year, so I had six or seven professional MMA fights, all that competition, all the jiu-jitsu, all the boxing, all of that. And I had signed to fight Jeremy Horn after he fought Chuck Liddell for the light heavyweight title.
Wow.
In my first year of competition at the Vivint Smart Home
You're
Arena.
Definitely an all-in kind of guy.
All in. And all of a sudden it was taken away because I thought I could help somebody who didn't want help.
Yeah.
And I got arrested. I had to call my boss. I had to call my family. I had to call Chelsea. And I had to say, hey, I got in trouble. I have to do this. You know, and after, and like that was just devastating. But after that happened.
Did any of those people in your life distrust your story? Did they believe that you weren't using? Did they worry that you'd gone back down that path?
My family was like, why were you hanging out with the people you used to use with? Right. And for me, I was like, I was trying to help him.
You were trying to do something good.
I was trying to do something good.
Noble.
But I was suggested by, you know, one of those people in long-term recovery to not hang with those people, and I thought I was different. And so that one mistake, the city charged me, and then the city dropped the charges because they thought they didn't have a case. The state picked it back up because of my priors, the felony drug charges, the DUI, the all the other
This
arrests.
Is where your past comes back to
My
haunt you.
My past come back to haunt me. Then they wanted to prosecute. So I got a public defender, and the public defender told me, you need to plea bargain. Otherwise, you're going to go to prison for like 20 years. Wow. And I said, I'm not going to plea bargain. I did commit. I am responsible for hanging out with him when I shouldn't have been. But I did not do what he said. And then I had people come forward and say, hey, man, he told me this story and he told me this story. And he'd, you know, made up stories kind of like I used to do when I was under the influence. I mean, I lived a lie and I had no idea what was true or false.
Yeah.
And so I got him to write the stories. And basically at a year sober, I was in front of a jury trial and I was like 2 or 3 weeks away from fighting Jeremy Horn and a week away from trying out for season 7 of The Ultimate Fighter as an undefeated athlete and one of the top MMA fighters in the state of Utah at the time.
Could you say this is one of your biggest fights ever?
Oh, it was by far. And in my mind, nothing mattered as long as I didn't drink or use and I continued to show up to the gym. I thought everything was going to be okay as long as I was honest.
So there you are standing in front of the judge fighting for really
and jury.
Your life. And jury.
I took it all the way to a jury trial against suggestion from my
I was going
to
say, that attorney. Takes a lot of courage because you're sitting there, and this is serious now. You're facing the potential of 20 years in prison, all of this that you've worked for.
I think
for
mandatory
going away.
Minimums, it would have been about 12 years.
Yeah, and your attorney's telling you, let's just plea bargain this. And what made you have the courage to say, no, I'm going to gather together these people's stories, and I'm going to go in there in front of the jury, and I'm going to defend myself. What made you do that?
Because I hadn't used and drank, and I remember what happened. I went there genuinely to help him, but he was not ready for help. And I remember the story. I remember walking into his house. I remember putting him in his bed. I remember having the conversation. I remember telling him that I loved him, but I couldn't help him. And if he gets sober, we can go meet in meetings, and we can do this recovery thing together. But if you're loaded, I can't help you.
Yeah.
And I left. And we were arguing, but I didn't touch him. You know, and so I'm standing from the jury trial, and that's exactly what I told him.
Yeah.
So you get the SUV moment where it's dun-dun, and the judge comes back.
Yep. And all of them found me not guilty on all charges.
Oh, that's great.
And I walked out of there, and I went and tried out for season 7 of The Ultimate Fighter the following week. I thought my poster with me and Jeremy Horn would get me on the show.
Right.
But my interview was, like, lackluster and crappy. It was like everybody else's interview. I was like, this is my last shot. You know, I have to make it on there. I'll never make it. And then they were like, great. Okay, well, we'll call you if we like you. So I made it all through the physical tryouts and then the interview because it's a reality television show.
Right.
I guess they didn't like me. So the following week, I went and fought Jeremy Horn, and I lost a really close decision. Mm. But after losing that decision, I thought, holy cow, I could have beat Jeremy Horn.
Yeah.
If I put a little bit more into my training.
That's
the
optimism.
If I put a little bit more into the fight. And I was like, I really got a shot at this. So just before that, though, I called my boss and I wanted Fridays off so I could train a little bit more and get some sparring in earlier at a gym with some athletes, Josh Berkman here, who was a UFC fighter at the time. And I'm like, I got to get some training in with these higher level guys so I can make it to that next level. And he said, Court, I can't give you a day off. You have to find a new job. And I was like, I got to take this shot. And he was like, all right, but if you come back, you can't be asking for days off. And I said, okay. And at the time, I was smoking a pack of Marlboro Blend 27s a day.
You're fighting,
training, competing in jiu-jitsu, boxing.
A pack a day.
I figured I was better smoking and training.
I feel like I'm sitting next to Superman here.
Right?
Hey, you. If you're struggling, man, and you're under the influence and you get sober, you tell me the energy. You show me the energy you have after you get sober. You can achieve incredible things. And so that's what was happening. And so, you know, it's like when I signed that fight to fight Jeremy Horn, I crumpled up my cigarettes and I threw them away. And that was October 27th, 2006. And I haven't smoked since.
Good for you.
And then I went and fought him. And I went through all that. I went through the jury trial. All that was done. And I was like, okay, I'm going to give myself 2 years to make it. I'm going to give myself 2 years to make it, and if I don't make it without providing for Chelsea and my son Isaac, who had been born at the time, then I'll go back to work as a plumber.
But you can say at least you gave it your best.
Yep. I could say I just gave it my best.
Yeah. All in.
All again. In. I saw the birth of my son sober, and then I proposed to my wife. Now, I'm a big fisherman, trout fisherman, and I have this favorite spot in Milton, Utah. So kind of by the Morgan area. Yeah,
that's my hometown.
And so I took her to this spot, and I decided I was going to propose to her. And so I tied a fake ring onto the line, casted it out, and then I was like, hey, babe, come here. And I grabbed this pole. And she like okay. And she started reeling it in, and I got down behind her, and she pulled it up, and it was a ring. And then I was sitting behind her with my little $248 wedding ring that all I could afford.
I'm glad you were smart enough to put the fake ring on the
The lock. Oh, dude, I wasn't about $248 was like a lot of money to me then.
Yeah,
I was
for sure.
Scrounging to make it because all the fines and lawyer fees SR22 insurance and all the stuff I had to go through. And so I proposed to her, and you know, it's like it was like that was it, man. It was like no turning back. So I put everything into my career. I moved down to Provo, Utah, to Utah County. I started working for this gym. It was Throwdown at the time. It was like some of the top coaches and a bunch of really hardcore MMA training partners and guys that were competing. And so I started training there, and I didn't look back. And right before I celebrated 3 years and right before my two-year mark of where I got to go back, I'd blown out my knee in training. I was having a hard time finding fights. I had only lost to Jeremy Horn. I was 11-1, and I was having a hard time making it into the UFC because it's challenging to get in there. And I couldn't find fights. I was a scary guy that nobody wanted to fight because I wasn't from a big-name gym, and I didn't have the huge fan following. And social media was still pretty new, you know, and it was like – or for me, at least it was, but I just...
And if you didn't get those fights, you weren't going to be able to get it in.
Because you made money off those fights, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's how you fed the family.
Yeah, well, that, and then I worked 20 hours a week at the gym, and then I ran the supplement shop, and I did plumbing side work. So I was working like 70, 80 hours
always
a week
a busy
and training
guy.
Full-time. Yeah, I was just doing whatever to make it. As long as my family had... My wife and son at the time had health insurance, I could pay my rent and pay my car payment. I was like, okay, as long as we can do that and we can eat, we're good. And so right at that two-year mark, I blew out my knee. I had surgery. And post-op, I had to go straight to work. I had to go straight to work like 2 hours after I had knee surgery.
Wow.
And I went into the gym. I taught a couple of my classes, and I was sitting. And I was thinking in my head because they put me under with anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And they... Part of being in recovery is I wasn't going to leave the hospital with narcotics. I was not going to leave with prescription pain pills because I knew where they would take me.
Yeah.
But I had to go to work right after. So I went to work, and man, my knee started throbbing and started hurting. And I started thinking in my head, okay, I'll call my wife, Chelsea, and I'll tell her to fill the pain prescription. I'll take two pills, but I'm going to eat first. So when I take the pills, it kind of gives me a buzz and then takes care of the pain. And then I went, uh-oh.
You could already see where this was going.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about it.
That addict's brain was kicking back in, wasn't it?
Yep.
Was it crazy how quick it kicked in?
Yeah. And I was in pain. And so I thought, well, am I taking it for the pain or am I taking it to get high? And I was freaking out in my head. And here I am sitting at work making shakes for people and teaching classes. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, man. And this guy walks in and he said, hey, somebody said you're in long-term recovery. Will you go to a meeting with me? And I was like, yeah. And I went into one of the recovery meetings, and I met a guy who changed my life. He was able to help me and walk me through a 12-step program, and just my life changed at that time. And 4 months later, my attitude and outlook on life had changed after completing, you know, a recovery program. And I met a guy. He walked in the gym. I'd never met him before. He had curly hair and a great big beard.
That seemed to be a constant story in your story, is somebody just walking in through a door that has changed your life.
Yep. And this guy said, hey, I want to come in and go to your guys' pro practice. And I was like, do you have any experience, like, training? And he's like, no, I played tennis in college. And I was like,
sounds good.
Okay. Yeah, if you come, you got to just work with me, though, because, like, there's some savages in there. And I was like, oh, I
they
don't
want
know
fresh meat,
do, you know, or whatever. And he was like his mid to late 30s. And I was like, I don't, maybe even early 40s. And I was like, oh, I don't know, man. But yeah, that's sure. After the practice was over, he was like, man, that was great. I love this sport. Hey, are you going to try out for the Ultimate Fighter next week? You'd be an idiot if you didn't. And he knew my whole record. He knew everything about me, all the guys that I fought. And he's like, man, you really got a good shot to make it into the UFC, make it on the Ultimate Fighter. Man, I think you'd be an idiot if you didn't go. And I was like, man, to tell you the truth, I don't make enough money to get myself there, and I would miss out on the $500 I make a week to support my family. And I said, I can't do it. I'll just make it in the hard way if I got to.
Yeah.
And in the back of my mind, I was thinking I'm about ready to just stop and go back to school and become a licensed
2 years plumber. Is up.
Yeah. And I don't know, 2 or 3 days later, he showed back up. He had an envelope with $500 in it. And he said, if you follow me out to my car, he handed it to me. And I was like, dude, I can't pay you back. There's no way. And he said, I don't want you to pay me back, but I want you to follow me out to my car. I'll book you a flight. You got to go try out. I'm like, who are you? And it was this guy named Will Farah. And I was just, I didn't know who he was. I had no idea what he was doing. And I was like, thank you, man. Yeah. I'll do what I can to pay you back. I don't want you to pay me back. I want you to go out there. And I was like,
wow.
All right.
That's
so
crazy.
That's what started. I went and tried out. I went and tried out, and I was in the interview, the same process as I went through a couple years earlier. And they said, what makes you different? Let me guess. Like, it's your last shot, right? It's your last shot to make it in the UFC. And I was like, no, it wasn't my last shot. I was like, nah, man, I just, the only thing that makes me different from any of these other guys that maybe is that I overdosed and died on heroin September 9th, 2005. And if I stay sober for another couple of months, I'll have 4 years of continuous sobriety. I said, maybe that's the only thing that makes me different. And they were like, great, we like you. Get out of here. Grabbed my bag and I walked out, and they called me 2 days later when I was at home, and they said, you made it on the show.
Yeah.
And then you won the whole entire thing.
I actually told them I wasn't coming.
What?
I hung up the phone and I called this recovery guru, one of the people in my life.
Some guy with sage advice.
Yep. And I was like, dude, I can't go on this show. There's alcohol. And I said, what if I win it and become famous?
So then for people listening, they know that you'd be in this house with other fighters, and they want
unlimited alcohol. They want to cause
some chaos and drama to happen, right?
Yep. And so he said, listen, Court, if you make it on that show, do you think you could possibly help somebody through your story that's struggling with addiction? And I was like, yeah, millions of people watch this show. And he's like, okay, do you think you could better financially provide for your family? I mean, that's what I wanted. And I was like, yeah, even if I make it on the show, my stock goes up in local venues. Oh, I'd be the main event all the time because I was the Ultimate Fighter guy, you know? And he said, well, what if you win it? And I was like, I guess you win a six-figure contract, and then you get a contract in the UFC, and you're fighting the biggest stage in the world against the best guys in the world. Yeah. And he's like, well, maybe I'll pray about it. So I said a little prayer. I didn't get anything from the prayer, but I was super sore. And so I took an Epsom salt bath, and I had a vision of me holding up the Ultimate Fighter trophy, and I knew that was my answer. I went on the show, and, 5 weeks later, I had made it into the finale. I came back home. I knew I was in the finale. I called my wife. I called that guy, Will, and I was like, dude, I made it into the finale. And I wasn't supposed to tell anybody, but I was like, dude, don't tell anybody, but I made it into the finale. I'm fighting for the six-figure contract. And he's like, I knew you would, buddy. I'm like, I'm proud of you, you know? And I called my wife, and I was like, hey, I made it in. And she's like, oh, that's good. I knew you would. And she was like, by the way, we're pregnant. And so my second son was on the way because we tried. See, she wanted to have a kid earlier, but I knew I couldn't provide for two kids. And so I kind of had to, like, hold off. And at the time, you know, my youngest son was, like, 2 years old. And I was like, I can't provide for him. And once I knew I was leaving for the house, I had this feeling that I was going to win it or life was going to change. And so we decided to try for a second kid.
Wow.
And so I came back with
Ultimate
Fighter news.
Are you good at everything you do?
Seems to be.
I just feel lucky, you know? Without a drink or drug, man, things change.
I didn't know it worked that way, but okay. Yeah.
Like I said,
I mean, I know how it works.
We're sitting next to Superman here.
And then... 6 weeks later, I got home. We didn't have coaches. The gym kind of switched up. And so I called Chuck Liddell, who was the coach on the season 11 Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, I don't really have a coach. And he said, I'll call you back. And he called John Hackelman, his coach. And he decided he was going to fly me out there, let me stay at his house, give me a vehicle to drive to and from. And I was going to practice right next to him because his fight was a week before mine. The coaches were fighting a week before. Oh. I was fighting for the six-figure contract in the finale a week after. So I went out. I trained. I trained next to Chuck Liddell with a bunch of high-level guys. And I got ready for the biggest fight of my life. And in my mind, it wasn't the biggest fight of my life. I had won the biggest fight of my life when I put that drink down April 16th, 2006.
Yeah.
And I'd made it through felony drug charges and felony burglary charges. And I made it through And so I thought, you know what, man, I've showed up to practice every day no matter what. I'll just show up for this one and do what I can. You know, my eye got cut. I had like 19 stitches under my eye a week before the fight.
Wow.
I had like a doc clean it up and I put some makeup on it. I went out to Las Vegas and I was the main event that night and I fought and I won. And when I held up the trophy, you know, he held the mic to me and I said, I want to dedicate this fight to all those who are struggling. And ever since then, the McGee Project started. And that's the foundation that I started a few years ago. But it started on that day when I broke the stigma of addiction and I decided to speak out as a person in long-term recovery. I dedicated my fight to all those who are struggling. And, you know, 17 fights later, here I am in the UFC, 9 years later, January 1st or 2nd when I fought my first fight to get in the house. I had four fights in the Ultimate Fighter House, all guys that had long careers in the UFC. They don't count those on my record, but I count those. Yeah. So that last fight that I had, UFC Fight Night Fort Lauderdale, was my 19th fight, 15th on their record or whatever, because they have to...
But see, this would all be amazing if your story just ended here. But you said you started the Court McGee Project.
Yeah.
And now you're doing amazing things. Like, I think a lot of people would look at you and go, you've done your work. Sit back and enjoy. But that's not how Court McGee works.
No. I have a responsibility to share my story. Not only is it a huge part of my recovery, is giving back what was so freely given to me, but there's a guy, he was in his late 80s, and he said, son, when the highlight of your life is working with a drug addict and alcoholic at the lowest of their time, you'll be living pretty good. Mm-hmm. And that stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And so I've tried to mimic that, not to mention that another was when I came out of my coma, and that role model with the solution gave me some suggestions to help me start my road to recovery. And it's like between those two guys and then all the experiences I had, I just kept doing that. I kept putting that first. And so I put recovery first and everything that came second got put first class. All of a sudden I was a father of two. You know, my first fight in the UFC, my son was in the NICU up until the day I left when he got out of the NICU. And I fought a week later.
Wow.
And it was one of the toughest fights of my life. I got my butt kicked the first round. I came back, and in the third round, I submitted him. And, you know, I've had all these fights, but I was like probably 5 years sober, you know, and I'm 13 years sober now. And I got a call from an undercover narcotics officer, left a message. And I got this message. And by this time, I had paid all my lawyer fees, court fines, restitution. I was completely off paper. I'd done 200 clean UAs. I had no more. I got out of the bad insurance that I had. Like, I had made it through all that stuff. And then I get a call from an undercover narcotics officer.
Freak you out?
Freaked me out. And I looked over to my wife and I was like, Chelsea, what do I do?
And when they leave messages, they don't say what it's about, right? They're just like, give me a call.
This is Detective So-and-so. We need, we need you to call us back. And I was like, oh, my heart stopped.
I bet.
You know, because I've got that call before.
And you start thinking in your head, what did I do?
I was just like, oh, no. You know, and I hadn't been in any trouble. And I was like, honey, what do I do? And she's like, call him back. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So I called him back and he said, hey, you know, this is Detective So-and-so. Hey, we're huge fans of yours. But I want you to know there was an officer the night you overdosed. He was involved in an officer accident. He's injured. He's off duty. But I'm putting on this program at the Utah State Capitol building. And it's this NADDI conference. It's for prescription narcotics. And I would love for you to be our speaker. Would you come up and share your story? Not to mention, I want to introduce you to the guy who was responsible for saving your life.
Wow.
And I was like, outside of sharing my story, I had shared my story in like recovery meetings and things like that, but I'd never really professionally shared my story or never shared it in public. I was open with my story and I had done a ton of interviews and I was always open with my recovery on interviews, saying I was in recovery, I was in long-term recovery, this is my experience. And so at the drop of a hat, I was like, yeah, I'll be there. Number one, I wanted to thank that guy. I wanted to give him a freaking kiss and a hug and tell him, man, I'm so thankful for you and so is my family. And I shared my story and it touched almost everybody in that room. And I was able to thank that officer and give him a big hug. And then after that, I was invited to speak at the Utah Anti-Narcotics Assembly, which is every undercover narcotics officer in the state of Utah. not only want to inspire them that they were doing good work, but share my story of overcoming addiction so that they could see that somebody who really struggled can make it out. We're not all failures. And that we can make a difference if we're given an opportunity, which I was given multiple. So I went down and I shared. And there was a rural community sheriff working for a sheriff's department in Emory County that said, came up to me after, and he said, "Hey, I think your story would be perfect for our high school. There's kids struggling and drinking, and we have, you know, and nobody can really get to them, and there's no programs for that. Would you be willing to come speak?" And at that time, I'd had a couple of fights, and I was about 2 weeks out. The time they wanted me to come down and speak to the two high schools and two junior highs, I was a week out from fighting at UFC fight night, Indianapolis, Indiana, and I was fighting Robert Whittaker, the current UFC middleweight champion, biggest fight of my life. He wasn't the champion at the time, but I knew he was the biggest prospect out of Australia. And so I thought, okay, you know what? I got to do this. This is the number one thing. This has to come first. So I brought a friend with me. I did some training while I was out there, and I walked into Emory High School, and I shared my story for the first time to a high school audience. And I was met with some confliction. I remember the principal was like, "We don't want a UFC fighter drug addict sharing to our kids." And the sheriff was like, "You got to have him come talk to the kids. You have to." Mm-hmm. And he came up, and right before I went on, he was like, "Dude, don't screw this up. It might be my job." And so I went up, I shared my story, and everybody was silent and they listened. And after it was over, I had hundreds and hundreds, like 600 kids come up to me and talk after.
Yeah.
And I had two or three that came up and shared their story that they were struggling. And I was able to offer some support and some suggestions, like that role model with a solution, the night that I came out of my coma.
Giving back.
And from that point on, I was like, I got to continue to do this. I went out and I fought and I beat Robert Whittaker 2 weeks later. Yeah. I came back home and I continued to do that. And the McGee Project started that day. And
I think a lot of people don't understand. Like, you were preparing for a huge fight. Most people's mind would say, I can't be distracted with trying to give back or speak at a high school in Emory County. Like, maybe I can do that another time. I think people don't understand the level of professional preparation that goes into these sorts of fights. Yet you went out and did it and were still able to maintain that focus and fight and win. And I think that in hearing your story and talking to you at other times, I know that connecting with people energizes you. Yep. Connecting with those kids really energized you that day. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, I get asked before I go out, "What do you fight for?" Right when I'm in the tunnel, walking out in front of 20,000 people, getting ready to fight. "What do you fight for? Find what you fight for." I know. I fight for those who are struggling out there to carry the message of hope and recovery. But once I started speaking in high school, see, there's roughly 23 million people in long-term recovery in the United States, and 90% of them started in their teenage years.
Yeah.
I reunited and married my high school sweetheart. Part of the sad side of my story is me and my three friends had one thing absolutely in common. All three of us would die of an accidental drug overdose, an opiate overdose. Only I was given a second chance, so I share their stories. Brady died on my six-year sobriety birthday, and I was able to not only forgive him, but speak at his funeral. And most of the high schools I speak at, I wear a pair of boots. Those are his boots that his mother gave to me to wear.
Wow.
And Cody died last fall, my other friend, of an accidental drug overdose. Two wonderful, incredible fathers, friends, fishermen, I mean, talented people that couldn't get a grip on their addiction. They couldn't achieve recovery, and they were lost. But they're not forgotten because I share my story, and I help break the silence of opioid addiction. I help break down some of the stigma by speaking up, because people suffer in silence. I didn't want to ask for help, and I was met with all these obstacles, but I continued to speak up and share my story. And every time I spoke up, even though I was met with obstacles, there were solutions that I found from that. And I mean, it's incredible. I've spoken at hundreds and hundreds of high schools. As a matter of fact, this will be our first annual juvenile justice tour for the four main juvenile justice facilities here in Utah. And that starts in June. I have all four facilities in June that I'll be touring and speaking at, creating hope and inspiration for those kids who are stuck in the criminal justice system.
And I'm so excited about that because most of those kids, they're 13, 14, 15 years old. These teenagers have never had somebody to, many of them have never had somebody to be a role model.
Idolize.
And inspire them. Yeah, somebody who can idolize, they can idolize, but they can relate to. You know, you've been in that system and you've had these experiences and you've gotten through it. And having had some experience working with those kids myself, I understand that so many of them are just desperate waiting for that connection with somebody. And that's one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show today to talk about this part of your story.
And see, that's what I like, because, you know, when you said when you met that first guy in the hospital that in 5 minutes you knew he's seen what you've seen and you could sympathize and you could recognize a lot of the stuff he is. And I think that you're going to be able to give that back with the youth of Utah and around the world. So what does the McGee Project look like today?
So we've traveled to 6 different states. I speak in high schools all over, alternative high schools, juvenile justice. I speak for the Mark Wahlberg Youth Foundation and DEA 360, the Youth Opioid Awareness Summits that are great big, you know, 5 to 10,000 students. I present at those. And it's like incredible because when I was in high school, there wasn't an assembly put on that talked about addiction from first-person perspective. It was always law enforcement saying, don't do this. It was always a teacher or a principal or
a cheesy video.
Or a cheesy video. Never from this guy experienced it and made it out, and he talked about it. And not only that, but I drank in high school because I thought it would be fun. And I could make recovery look attractive because I have fished all over the world and I've done that sober. I have fought some of the best guys in the world. You know, like I've done all these incredible things and I've done them sober, and it's a blast. Like I love my life today. I became a father, you know, a husband, a professional athlete, and now a professional speaker. And so the McGee Project, it not only educates students, not necessarily who struggle, but encourages them and educates them, but the kids who are starting to struggle or come or are starting to have issues or have tried, I can get them an education based on my personal experience of where drug addiction can take them and how fast it can take them.
Yeah, because you escalated quick.
Very quick.
Yeah, that's a unique thing, or maybe I don't know how unique it is necessarily, but I think it's unique. We usually hear about months and years of a person using until it eventually, and yours was like, boom.
Yeah.
In 1 year, you were hooked.
And lost everything. Yeah. Lost absolutely everything. And so I put a presentation together. I meet with counselors. I have a whole curriculum. And so we coach the counselors and the principal and faculty. And then we put it on Canvas. And then all the students know that Court McGee's coming and the McGee Project's coming. And then we put on an assembly. And every student shows up. And then I put on a presentation. I have a short film that lets them know a little bit of my story, and then they get on and I share a portion of my story to help educate people on addiction, to help break some of the stigma surrounding addiction, and then to help motivate kids who are already starting to use or even struggling a way out, and giving them direction and purpose. And then kids come forward after, and some of them need help, and I'm in a position to where I have a good group of people around us at the McGee Project where we can help each individual kid, and we can introduce them to people that can help them, licensed clinical social workers, counselors.
Wow. Have,
you know, with treatment. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and, you know, it's the best thing I've ever done,
and it's the most powerful
thing I've ever done. I just got back from Washington, D.C., the congressional offices. I met with both of our state senators here in Utah, Senator Romney and Senator Lee, and I was able to talk and work together with them on helping break some of the stigma surrounding addiction, and then talk about my project, as well as partnering with Facebook SOS. They did a short documentary film. If anybody's on Facebook, you're going to see it. It's all over the place now. Yep. They did these short films from 12 different stories of 12 people from the hardest hit states in the country. And here in Utah, we're one of the hardest hit states. of accidental drug overdose right. and deaths.
Yeah. Well, Court, thank you very much for sharing your story, being honest and being raw, and congratulations on all your success and what you're doing to change people's lives. One last question, because your story is so amazing. It almost sounds like a Disney movie. So if they were to make a movie about you, what actor do you want to play you?
Ooh. I don't know, because I don't know anybody who looks like me, but maybe like Josh Brolin or Mark Wahlberg.
There you go. Hey, if people want more information about you, where do they go?
So you can go to our website, the McGee Project website. It's mcgeeproject.org. So mcgeeproject.org.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Project Recovery. And Project Recovery is brought to you by Reprieve Recovery up there in Morgan, Utah, an all-women's facility. For more information about them and all the things that they're doing in the world of recovery, check them out at ReprieveRC.com. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what, Dr. Matt?
It's a KSL podcast.